mentioned, the Lebrecht interview is on the air later at 10 o'clock after our prom, and that's followed by the first of this week's essays looking at the music appreciation movement. Richard Witts explains the ambitions and idiosyncrasies of this movement from the early 20th century, and tonight he begins by discussing the work of its British pioneer, Percy Shoals. That's the essay tonight at 10:45. This is BBC Radio 3. It's now just after 7:30 and time to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom. It's presented by Kirsty Young and Louise Fryer.
All season, the proms has been celebrating anniversaries. This evening, it's not the anniversary of a particular composer or a musician, but of a radio programme. BBC Radio 4's Desert Island Discs notched up 70 years back in January. And tonight, the programme's current presenter, Kirsty Young, will be taking to the stage of the Royal Albert Hall, along with a number of well-known castaways. Their musical choices range from Bach to Beethoven to the Beatles, performed live for us by the BBC Concert Orchestra, which is itself celebrating an anniversary. This particularly versatile ensemble was founded 60 years ago in 1952. Well, already on stage with the orchestra are the Huddersfield Choral Society, and they're going to be joined by a host of soloists. Soprano and former Radio 3 New Generation artist Edish Tynan, bass baritone Bryn Terville stepping in at the last moment to replace Sir Willard White, who's unwell. Baritone Simon Butteris is making his proms debut, and vocalist Anna Jane Casey, who was on stage here just last week performing in the John Wilson prom devoted to the Broadway sound. And it's not only singers. Wayne Marshall will be playing the Royal Albert Hall organ, Peter Donohoe the piano, and New Generation artist Nicola Altstedt his cello. So there's a huge variety of talent and musical genres on show. That applause is for the leader of the BBC Concert Orchestra, Charles Mutter. And the orchestra is going to begin this Desert Island Discs prom with a well-known theme tune. Usually you only get to hear the first 20 seconds. This time we can hear it in its entirety. And to conduct it, here comes the principal conductor of the BBC Concert Orchestra, Keith Lockhart.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and welcome to this very special prom celebrating 70 years of Desert Island Discs. Tonight, we are going to transform this magnificent Royal Albert Hall into a vast desert island, as I'm joined by no fewer than 9 former castaways, reflecting on the music that they chose as guests on the programme, music that they say they simply couldn't live without. And instead of having to make do with an old wind-up gramophone and an inexhaustible supply of needles, tonight they have the benefit of a real live orchestra, the BBC Concert Orchestra, no less, with a lineup of distinguished soloists and their principal conductor, Keith Lockhart. And they have just been performing that familiar piece there by Eric Coates. By the Sleepy Lagoon may have been inspired by, I'm afraid to say it, a trip to Bognor, rather than anywhere exotic, but it is music that has been the programme's signature tune ever since Desert Island Discs was first aired. That was back, of course, in 1942. So our first castaway of the evening came onto Desert Island Discs in 2006 to talk about her astonishing career. Aged just 16, she was spotted by Kenneth McMillan, who created a role especially for her in his ballet, The Prince of the Pagodas. She became the Royal Ballet's youngest ever principal dancer at the age of just 20. She was awarded an OBE in 1995 and a CBE on her retirement. That was in 2006. Her book on the island? Well, she chose a biography of Audrey Hepburn. And her luxury? Well, that was an eyelash curler. She is the very brilliant and the very beautiful Darcy Bustle. Welcome. Thank you. Darcy, thank you so much for joining us. Everybody always wants to know, I guess, what is it like to be cast away? What is it like?
No, well, it's lovely, but it's funny, actually, it's been some time, and I probably would have changed some things. Probably would have changed my eyelash curler to a dictionary on Strictly Come Dancing.
Right. Best of luck with that. Speaking of dancing, you only chose one piece of ballet music you chose. Why just the one? And tell us what it was.
Well, this was one of my most favorite roles. I think just basically because you could get so carried away. The music itself tells the narrative so perfectly. Every beat, you feel an emotion within it. So as a dancer, it's so easy to play. Of course, it's Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet. And I know they're going to play Dance of the Nights.
They are going to play it for us this evening. Darcy Bustle, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Keith Lockhart and the BBC Concert Orchestra, it's over to you. So that was Dance of the Nights from Prokofiev's ballet Romeo and Juliet, Keith Lockhart conducting the BBC Concert Orchestra. Now, I've come up to the organ loft to reach my next castaway, who is just about to be seated at this console. He is the organist, conductor, and composer, of course, Wayne Marshall. Now, it was 10 years ago, Wayne, that you were exiled to your desert island. You took as your luxury a Steinway Model D piano, and cunningly, you had it conditioned to deal with all weathers, which was a very smart thing to do. So you could enjoy more music than most other castaways by having that literally at your fingertips, but I'm wondering how it would compare, the Steinway, with a magnificent organ like this one here.
Well, a Steinway, of course, would have been fantastic, absolutely fantastic, because, of course, it's such an easy instrument to transport. Can one... I mean, could you imagine transporting something like the Albert Hall organ to an island?
We've been asked for stranger things than that, yeah. I have to say. Tell us a bit about the piece you've chosen tonight, and indeed why you've chosen it.
Well, the Toccata and Fugue in D minor by Johann Sebastian Bach is, I think, one of his most famous pieces of organ music. And it's a piece which I think owes its popularity to the fact that it has a very striking opening. And of course, it's been made famous by many people. But it's a piece which is so easily recognizable. And I think it certainly has a great place in the organ repertoire. And tonight, in fact, I want to dedicate my performance to Carlo Curley, who died suddenly on the 11th of August this year. Thank you. And Carlo was a great friend, and I was very, very shocked to hear of his death, but tonight I really want to play it in his memory.
Thank you very much. We look forward to that being dedicated to that organist's memory. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, what about that? The inimitable Wayne Marshall playing Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor. Wayne is just one of many distinguished musicians who've been castaways over the 70 years that Desert Island Discs has been captivating listeners. It all began as Roy Plumley was sitting in his pajamas. Late one evening, he was struck by an idea for what he thought might be quite a nice radio program. He immediately wrote to the BBC. The head of popular record programs at the time, Leslie Perrone, plucked the letter from his in tray, and so Desert Island Discs was born. Roy Plumley, of course, was also the program's first presenter, a job he enjoyed for 43 years. Let's hear him in action. This is from 1977, when his guest was a young woman, a world-famous cellist.
On this occasion, I'm visiting Jacqueline Dupré. Jacqueline, it's just 8 records, and this is a great problem for anyone who lives with music to the extent that you do.
Well, in a sense, I feel it's a very lucky thing, because on the 8 records, I can perhaps bring my friends with me to the island.
You had a wonderful gift from an anonymous admirer of a really beautiful cello.
I certainly did. In fact, to me it is my fairy godmother. It was a Stradivarius cello, and I obviously loved it and put all my musical love and thoughts into it.
Now, Jacqueline, in July 71, it was announced that you had nervous exhaustion and were going to rest for a year, and everyone had said, oh, poor girl, she's been overdoing it. You were back in the concert hall the following year, but only for a few months. Then we realized that it wasn't just nervous exhaustion.
No, it turned out, in fact, to be multiple sclerosis.
It struck you down right at the peak of your career. It must have taken a tremendous effort to come to terms with it.
It does take a tremendous effort, because one is naturally very frightened by it. It took me a long time to come to any kind of grips with what had happened. Mm-hmm. But then I can say that in a sense I'm lucky, because the cello repertoire is small. I had done most of what I loved, and I can look back on a full musical, cellistic life. I'm quite busy teaching now. It's something I realize that I love very much, and this gives me great pleasure.
So that was Roy Plumley with his castaway there, of course, Jacqueline Dupré. She was synonymous with one particular piece of music, her interpretation described at the time as definitive. That was in 1965, when she was 20 years old. The piece, of course, was Elgar's Cello Concerto. So this is a piece that has, as you would imagine, been much requested over the years. Here to play it for us this evening, another young star cellist, Radio 3 new generation artist, Nicola Austedt.
Thank you.
So Nicola Auerstedt was the soloist in the first movement of Elgar's cello concerto. That has been chosen, incidentally, 51 times by Desert Island Castaways, including, I'll come to you in a minute, including Daniel Barenboim, who of course was married to Jacqueline Dupré, and he conducted a complete cycle of Beethoven symphonies here at the Proms just a matter of a few weeks ago. So with me now is another stellar name, the great bass baritone Bryn Terfel, who, as we heard, very gallantly stepped in at very short notice. Bryn, you yourself were cast out in 2003, I think, and confess to all of the people at the Royal Albert Hall what you took as your little luxury.
I did.
What was it?
It was the Millennium Centre, wasn't it?
Yes. It was the Millennium Centre in Cardiff. Why did you choose the Millennium Centre in Cardiff?
Well, I thought it was a very clever choice, actually, because you have rehearsal rooms, pianos scattered all over the place. Right. I could sing to my heart's content.
Right.
A couple of bars, a couple of restaurants. Sometimes an audience. And, of course, if it did land on a desert island somewhere, it wouldn't look out of place, really, would it?
Right. No, well, to say you're stretching the rules of desert island discs seems something of an understatement. Anyway, another very surprising luxury that was chosen on desert island discs was by the late character actor Stanley Holloway. He chose, you're going to love this, a parking meter and plenty of change. And both times that he was on Desert Islanders, he also chose a really beautiful piece of music by Coleridge Taylor that we're going to hear next. We're marking the centenary of the death of this fascinating composer, and this is a deeply moving episode we're going to hear now from his choral work, Hiawatha. It describes the death of Minnehaha, Hiawatha's wife, and in this performance, it features the Huddersfield Choral Society with the BBC Concert Orchestra and Bryn Terfel singing the part of Hiawatha.
Thank you. Thank you.
So that was Bryn Terfel and the Huddersfield Choral Society singing The Death of Minnehaha from Hiawatha by Samuel Coleridge Taylor. Well, with me now, lurking in the wings, are two people. I really don't need to introduce them, but I'm going to anyway because it only seems so polite to do so. Sue Lawley and Sir Michael Parkinson. Welcome to the Royal Albert Hall. I'm not going to ask you to do a duet, although it almost looks as though you're going to start one. But I should tell people that together with Roy Plumley and myself, we span the 70 years that Desert Island Discs has been on air as presenters. Sue, you famously once said, at least I read that you said it, that's not always the case that you did say it when you read that you said it.
As we know.
As we know. But that Desert Island Discs was one of the best jobs in radio to present it. Did you say
the
it?
The best on-air jobs in the BBC, I think. Right. I mean, mainly because you get to interview all kinds of interesting, entertaining, distinguished people. B, they come on like a shot. You don't have to cajole them or pay them, and they're not promoting a book or a film, are they, Michael? They just walk on. But the best thing is, of course, the magic ingredient of music. And that is really what does the trick, because you get to find out about these people much more than you would know to ask. You know, Daniel Barenboim, you mentioned just now, said in the Reith Lectures that music reaches a place that other things can't reach. I think they said it about a lager as well, but, you know. And it's true, and therefore you get a very intimate interview from someone through their musical choices, and it's a biographical interview with musical illustration, but actually the whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
Sir Michael, when you took on Desert Island Discs, you know, you were the undisputed king of the television interview. Some people were surprised that you were bothering to come and do a radio program. What were the differences between interviewing people on television and coming in to do Desert Island Discs?
I'm known particularly actually for being the oldest. I'm older than the show. I'm the only presenter who's older than the show. I just found it totally irresistible in any interview, well, because of what Sue was saying. There's a kind of a fatigue sets in with interviewers and interviewees. Famous people get interviewed an awful lot. Interviewers who interview famous people an awful lot. As you were saying, and the new dimension that music gives to it freshens everything. It makes it a different kind of interview and a different kind of approach. And also, you couldn't turn down an institution like that, could you? You'd have to be mad, quite frankly.
You would have to be mad.
Some people have. We shall not mention their names.
Have they? So you were there for 18 years. In that 18 years, was there a particular memory that is, I mean, I'm sure you have a lot of memories because, you know, it's such a rich program to do, but a particular piece of music maybe or a particular memory that stayed strongly with you?
Repertoire, as it were, has been expanded hugely from kind of Nora Jones and the Jam to kind of pieces by lesser-known pieces of the great composers. But I suppose the piece that for me symbolises the desert island, and I would now take it with me if I ever ended up on one, and that is Schubert's String Quintet, because it is quite beautiful. It is, as Mitsuko Uchida, the distinguished and incredibly charming concert pianist, said, the music of death. She believed that Schubert, who wrote it towards the end of his life, actually had passed over, as she put it, when he wrote it, right. And she may be right.
Sir Michael, memory, I mean, it doesn't have to be a musical memory, a strong memory, something that makes you
it
smile.
It was interesting watching people's reaction when you played the music. Often you got a clue from that, the real reason why they chose it. But I remember Bob Maxwell in the break in the interview, and he pressed down the button to the control room and told his PA to get Chairman Mao on the phone. Now, it might have been Chuen Lai, it might have been the Dalai Lama, it was somebody absurd like that.
Right.
And I was so shaken, and I said to him, I said, if you get through to him, ask him if he's free to do Desert Island Discs. It was extraordinary behaviour. It was kind of one-upmanship of the highest order, you know. You might think yourself, but I know the head of the Communist Party in China.
Watch out, kid.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much to you both. We should say that not only were you esteemed presenters, you also both, in your time, were guests on Desert Island Discs.
We were.
That relates to the next bit. Because
he did me.
Yes.
I did her.
As it were.
Me, though,
yes.
No, as it were, no. It's one of the great regrets in my life.
I won't ask how she was. I'll just say thank you very much for joining us.
This won't get in. You know that, don't you?
This is live. This is going out now. Now, when Sue...
And we're leaving together.
Yes. People will talk, you know.
I hope so.
We're going.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much indeed. When Sue was cast away, one of her 8 discs included music by the Beatles, and you can imagine she was not alone. The Fab Four have featured in the choices of no fewer than 265 castaways: politicians, musicians, writers, performers, sportsmen, designers, even horticulturalists. Rob Mathis has arranged 4 of the Beatles' best-loved tunes for us tonight.
Thank you.
the BBC Concert Orchestra leader Charles Mutter and conductor Keith Lockhart, with Rob Mathis's arrangement of four songs by the Beatles, and we ended, of course, there with Long and Winding Road. About to join me now is a man who himself has taken many long and winding journeys in the course of his career as a naturalist and a broadcaster, and taken time out on an imaginary desert island no fewer than four times. Only Arthur Askey came onto the desert island as many times as that. He is the great Sir David Attenborough. Good evening. A pleasure to see you. How are you?
Thank you very much.
So welcome. I should remind people you were Roy Plumley's guest twice. That was, I've got it down here, 1957,
yes.
1979. Then you chatted to Sue Lawley in 1998, and I was lucky enough to have you on the programme in January of this year as our very special 70th anniversary guest.
It was. Thank you.
I could say that we're almost finding you in your natural habitat this evening, because you really do like the proms. I mean, you're a regular.
Yeah, yes, I've been coming to the proms certainly for 60 years. I used to live down the road. Right. I have promed. I've never done the stalwart things that some people here do, to go to every single one, but I've been to quite a lot, and I come, yes, pretty regularly.
And so four Desert Island Discs appearances. Did your music change? How did your music change throughout the decades?
Well, that's a consequence of coming to the proms, actually. You hear the marvellous thing about the proms is the great mixture, isn't it? I mean, I came a few nights ago to listen to Brahms and found myself listening to a piece I'd never heard before called by Luther Slavsky, and it was electrifying. It was marvellous, and that's what the proms does, which is a thrill.
Well, it was a thrill for me to have you as our esteemed 70th birthday guest. Thank you so much for coming along tonight, and we hope you're going to enjoy, indeed I know you are going to enjoy, this next piece of music. So David Attenborough, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
So, Sir David and many other castaways have chosen music by Handel, and we have some of that to take us up to the interval tonight. The Huddersfield Choral Society joined the concert orchestra in two excerpts from Handel's Oratorio Messiah and The Glory of the Lord, followed by the magnificently uplifting Hallelujah Chorus.
The glory of the Lord shall be revealed.
two excerpts from Handel's Messiah and The Glory of the Lord, and bringing the first half of this Desert Island Discs prom to a rousing finish, the Hallelujah Chorus, also bringing many of the audience here at the Royal Albert Hall to their feet. Keith Lockhart conducting the BBC Concert Orchestra and the Huddersfield Choral Society. The Hallelujah Chorus has been chosen on no fewer than 41 occasions by castaways including Charles McKerris in 1975, the comedian Eric Sykes in 1997, and the historian David Starkey in 2005. Well, Desert Island Discs presenter Kirsty Young will be back on stage here at the Royal Albert Hall with more castaways in around 20 minutes. But first, it's time to join Mariella Frostrup and her guests for tonight's Proms Plus Literary event, exploring Desert Island book choices. It was recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, just across the road from us here at the Royal Albert Hall.
For a bookworm, the prospect of being stuck on a desert island with nothing but the screech of gulls and the waves lapping on the shore to distract you from your reading has much to recommend it. But once you've ploughed through your complete Shakespeare and delved deep into the Bible, what sort of choices have Desert Island Discs castaways made to pep up that literary diet? Tonight, we're going to be talking about the Desert Island book nominations over 70 years of Radio 4's iconic programme and discovering what those titles say about the castaways and the programmes themselves. To help me explore these fascinating and sometimes downright masochistic choices, from Silence of the Lambs to a timetable of steamers, I'm delighted to welcome the lyricist and cricket fanatic Sir Tim Rice, honoured as a castaway not once but twice, Dame Harriet Walter, an RSC stalwart and known on the small screen as D.I. Natalie Chandler in Law and Order, also a castaway, who'll be bringing some of the book choices to life, and finally, the writer Kevin Jackson, who we've cast as our literary sleuth, forensically studying the archive. Now, Kevin, as I said, you've delved deep into the book choices over 70 years. Does anyone actually pick their favourite book?
I'm not going to suggest that anybody ever shows off on Desert Island Discs. That would be quite unthinkable in our nation. What's really seemed to emerge, I think, is that to place a good construction on it, people often choose the great big book that they haven't actually got around to reading. They think, well, I'm going to be stuck on this island for who knows how many years. It better be something big. So War and Peace is very popular. Some of the longer Dickens novels are very popular. Surprisingly popular is Gibbon, who I think very few people these days actually read for pleasure. Though, in fact, if you dip into the footnotes, he's kind of fun. Overall, absolute outright winner, no question, no hods barred, is Proust.
We'll be coming to Proust in a moment, don't rush me. Okay. But Tim, you having been a castaway, not once but twice, as I pointed out, is it true that you're never trying to show off when you make your book choices? Or is there a bit of a thought about how people are going to perceive the book you choose?
I don't know. I think perhaps in my case I had a bit of reverse snobbery or reverse showing off. I chose Alice in Wonderland, or actually the complete works of Lewis Carroll the first time around. Alice in Wonderland was one of my favourite books as a child, and indeed still is one of my favourite. But I wanted the complete works of Lewis Carroll because he also wrote a lot of books on mathematics and logic and calculus and all that. And I thought if you're on the desert island, you would have great fun trying to, or I would have great fun, most people probably wouldn't, trying to find how numbers worked and what they can do. And some of his puzzles and problems, I think, would have kept me happy. Second time around, I chose Molesworth, which... I do love, but it's not exactly very intellectual. I probably should have gone for Proust and impressed people. I played the game as if I were stranded. I think it's more fun doing that. And I think, I mean, Proust, I've never read a word of Proust, I'm ashamed to say.
Harriet, perhaps for Tim's benefit, you could read us a bit of Proust from À la recherche de temps perdu.
This is from The Way by Swans, Part 1, Cambrai. For a long time, I went to bed early. Sometimes, my candle scarcely out, my eyes would close so quickly that I did not have time to say to myself, I'm falling asleep. And half an hour later, the thought that it was time to try to sleep would wake me. I wanted to put down the book I thought I still had in my hands and blow out my light. I had not ceased while sleeping to form reflections on what I'd just read, but these reflections had taken a rather peculiar turn. It seemed to me that I myself was what the book was talking about. A church, a quartet, the rivalry between François I and Charles V. This belief lived on for a few seconds after my waking. It did not shock my reason, but lay heavy like scales on my eyes and kept them from realising that the candlestick was no longer lit.
What is it about that particular book, do you think? Why do people choose it?
I think it divides between those for whom it is a sort of sacred book. Proustians tend to be somewhat fanatical, and for a work which is very much about the anatomy of snobbery in many ways, I'm afraid there is a tremendous amount of snobbery attached to Proust, who, by the way, from what I've read, which is about a quarter of the whole thing, is fantastic. But, you know, it is a desert island book. I think for others it's simply that mere thing of what is the longest book I can think of? And, you know, it's very long. And I think it has that immense virtue. You think, presumably one of the things about the books, and I think people cheat when they do survival type books, you know, how to build a raft, that kind of thing. I think it's the kind of thing that makes you feel that you can live imaginatively in a completely other world. And the fact that you're there alone, and Proust's book is partly about solitude, but partly also about the experience of society, I think, you know, you would feel like you were living amongst a very rich gallery of people.
Harriet, it is a bit like writing a narrative of your life, isn't it, appearing on Desert Island Discs? Did you feel it like that? And is it hard not to try and author it as a result? You know, rock stars choosing economists, actors choosing scientists, Tracy Emin choosing Spinoza.
I couldn't be a snob about literature because, I wouldn't know where to start. I very much was torn between a book that I wanted to read that I'd heard was good but had never read, you know, like War and Peace or something, and something that I loved very much and wanted to return to for comfort. I think in one way, if I was really honest, I'd have chosen Dickens. But I didn't. I thought, I'm going to do a woman, you know, let's always promote the woman. And I also genuinely thought, you know, I'm so scared of the thought of being left alone on an island. If I chose a woman who, as I did, had been a poor little invalid in Victorian life and had gone out and braved the world and been a fantastically adventurous traveller, she'd make me feel rather sort of okay to be alone on an island. So I said, it was rather...
Though I have to say, the passage you've chosen made me feel totally unadventurous. I mean, she really is feisty. Could you perhaps read that?
Well, she didn't start feisty. The thing, this is Isabella Bird, who was treated as an invalid most of her life and sent to Hawaii to kind of for her health, for sort of TB reasons, and then took so much to the idea of being in foreign parts that she spent the rest of her life travelling all over the world, and she was about 4 foot something. Every time she went back home to Britain, she fell ill again and lay on the sofa. So I just found her fascinating. And this is her talking about her adventures in the Rocky Mountains. I was dizzied and breathless by the pace at which we were going. A shorter time than it takes to tell, it brought us close to and abreast of the surge of cattle. The bovine waves were a grand sight. Huge bulls shaped like buffaloes bellowed and roared, and with great oxen and cows with yearling calves galloped like racers, and we galloped alongside of them and shortly headed them, and in no time were placed as sentinels across the mouth of the valley. It seemed like infantry, awaiting the shock of cavalry as we stood as still as our excited horses would allow. I almost quailed as the surge came on, but when it got close to us, my comrades hooted fearfully, and we dashed forward with the dogs, and with bellowing, roaring, and thunder of hooves, the wave receded as it came.
Well, definitely a classic and very much of its time. And the list really heavily favours classics, doesn't it, Kevin?
Very much so.
Why do you think that is? Do you think it's because people sort of finally think, well, I'll have the time at last to approach that great tome that I've meant to read all my life?
That's definitely true, and I think there's also the sense of the tried and tested, that nobody's particularly impressed if you've read the latest, shall we say, Shopaholic novel or something like that. But if you've, you know, if you actually have read Gargantua and Pantagruel, people might avoid you as being a bore, but they'll be quite impressed. I did a rough estimate. I don't think there are probably more than about a dozen living writers on the list, perhaps a few more, but not many. You can see certain patterns coming out, and it's interesting kind of what gets neglected. I mean, virtually the entire 18th century, apart from Samuel Johnson, is forgotten. Pope, Swift, Burke, you name it, they're not there.
Tim, I mean, is there a sense that people want to learn something, that they want to come out of the experience having discovered something, maybe even something practical? I know Trevor Nunn picked a yoga manual, which I thought was quite a good idea, actually.
It all depends how you play the game, which applies to the music as well as the books. You can play it, just choose records and a book that have meant something to you, or you can actually choose something that you think will keep you alive and sane on the island. Sometimes the two are the same thing. I mean, I would have loved to have taken a big novel, but I thought, well, if I take the wrong one and I don't like it, I'm safer with Lewis Carroll or Molesworth. And interestingly, with people like Proust and, you know, Tolstoy, I mean, presumably it depends on which translation you get, because I would imagine Proust has been translated brilliantly and badly. So you've got to know which version to get, unless you want to try and read it in the original French, which actually would be quite interesting because that would occupy a lot of time. Well, but then you need a French dictionary. It's
getting quite convoluted, yes, isn't it? But let's move on to someone that I presume people are choosing in translation, because otherwise the intellectuals on Desert Island Discs are even more intellectual than we ever imagined. Dante's Divine Comedy. Again, why a top choice, Kevin?
It's one of my. I have two choices. One is Molesworth, which is my pleasurable choice, and then I have Dante, which is my serious choice. And Dante, because it's a very short poem. You could actually read the damn thing in about a day. The damn thing. That was absolutely unintentional. And yet, you know, you can spend a lifetime reading it and you don't exhaust it. It's, as a friend of mine used to say, like a multi-story car park, it operates on many levels. So you can read it simply for the story, which is a damned gripping story, again, or you can read it for, you know, the various levels of sort of intellectual debate which take part in it. And it's very beautiful and very frightening.
Midway upon the journey of our life, I found myself within a forest dark, for the straightforward pathway had been lost. Ah me, how hard a thing it is to say what was this forest savage, rough and stern, which in the very thought renews the fear. So bitter is it, death is little more, but of the good to treat which there I found, speak will I of the other things I saw there. I did do it at Italian A-level, and the sound is rather beautiful, but it refers all the time to sort of people who were prominent in 14th century Italy, who you've got to look up the footnotes for to know what they were about.
It's quite staggeringly violent at times as well, isn't it? You know, that the number of mutilations, I mean, the character Bertrand de Born, who walks around holding his own head, which he shouts out at, for example, is pretty memorable. There's also people being disemboweled and bathing in blood, and there are rains of what I think I politely could call excrement. It's a chamber of horrors.
I think people choose it because they feel rather glad that they're slightly in a better place.
But is it the sort of book, I mean, it's a bit like Silence of the Lambs, which I know was chosen as well. Is it the sort of book that you'd want to read when you're stuck in a remote, barren place, alone? Tim?
As you reach your twilight years, I think you feel you'd rather read things that you know are good, that history or posterity has told you that's good, not posterity, what's the opposite of that? Anyway, books that you know are almost certainly going to be brilliant because they've survived, rather than take a punt on something which might be great, but, you know, I mean, I haven't got time to listen to brilliant current pop singers like Jessie J with any great detail, because I'd rather listen to the Everly Brothers again, you know, because I know they're good. I haven't got much time left to get into new people.
Come, come.
Although I do like Jessie J.
Are there surprising absences from the list, Kevin?
There's not much poetry. I sort of expected rather more. And what poetry does come up is fairly conventional. I was kind of surprised that more people didn't choose Philip Larkin, who I think is, you know, usually considered one of the best loved poets, if not the best poets of the last century. People who chose T.S. Eliot, who supposedly, according to the BBC poll, our favourite poet of the 20th century, is only represented a few times by four quartets rather than by the entire body of work. And the entire body of work is only about 200 pages, so you felt they were being a bit sort of self-limiting.
I'm surprised there's so few contemporary novels as well, or novels by living authors.
It's very interesting, that point, because there's an awful lot of music is chosen by people who are still alive. And I remember when I was doing it, choosing, you know, one or two pop records, and sometimes by people I knew. One would think, I've got to have a record by this artist because they'll be terribly offended if I don't have them. They couldn't give us stuff, frankly, because they wouldn't hear the programme.
You mentioned a love of maths earlier, and composer John Rutter chose Teach Yourself Mathematics, illustrated by voluptuous women. Slightly beggars belief.
Really?
Would that be your ideal choice, then?
Well, I haven't read that particular book.
I'm not sure he read it either.
I do like books on numbers and mathematics. I mean, I'm a bit of an anorak, really. I mean, most of my interests in life, like cricket and astronomy, have emerged from, you know, liking numbers. I do find there's a great beauty in mathematics, because mathematics exists. If man didn't exist, mathematics would. Pi would still be 3.14159, even if we weren't here.
Let's see an example, Harriet, of the sort of thing Tim would consider now to be really unputdownable.
Tim,
this is for you, all right. It follows from the definition of perfection that the sum of reciprocals of the divisors of a perfect number is 2. For example, since 28 plus 28 equals 1 plus 2 plus 4 plus 7 plus 14 plus 28. We can divide through by 28 and obtain 2 equals 1 28th plus 1 14th plus 1 7th plus 1 quarter plus half plus 1.
Well, that was from the Penguin Book of Curious and Interesting Numbers by David Wells, and it was about the number 28, in case you hadn't guessed. Is it a good example, though, Kevin, of something that we should take heart from, which is the sort of human striving for betterment, as it were, that there are a lot of books on this list that are all about people wanting to achieve something, to better themselves, to use this time constructively.
I mean, I think the basic idea of the book is to say something about your own personality, really, isn't it? It's a book that's meant a lot to you, or a book that says something about what you basically are in your imagination. But a lot of people are self-improvers, and I think that's a very good thing.
And if it is about showing your personality, what does it say about you two gentlemen, both of whom would have chosen Molesworth? I'll give you first voice on this, Tim.
Well, I suppose in my case, Molesworth, again, was something from my childhood. And I think, again, the older you get, the more you look back on things that you loved in your childhood, because you were certain that you loved them when you were a kid. And then you grow up, and you're not certain that you really love the things you think you do. But when you get, you know, a little bit older, you think, hang on, I know I love that. I know I loved astronomy. I know I love the planet Saturn. I know I love Nigel Molesworth. And also, as it happens, Molesworth is a brilliant book. He's a great philosopher, Nigel Molesworth. He's up there with, you know, Popper and Wittgenstein. He really has a great view on life in the 50s for a young person. And it's very funny, very witty.
There are also, actually, Kevin, I mean, I want to know why you chose Molesworth as well, but there's also very few funny books on the list. And actually, one of the things you'd think there'd be a dearth of on the island would be laughter, because it's quite hard to make yourself laugh.
There are a few books. I mean, there are things which, Three Men in a Boat was, I think, chosen by Vic Reeves. A very charming book, which, you know, has that quality of idyll and paradise about it as well. Wind in the Willows is not exactly a funny book, although it does have very nice humorous passages. That's quite popular.
It's more whimsical, isn't it?
Yeah, some Dickens novels. Obviously, there's a lot of wonderful humor in Dickens, like we were talking earlier about the passage in Great Expectations where Mr. Wopsle plays Hamlet, which has made me cry with laughter.
Winnie the Pooh?
Winnie the Pooh, yes.
Bit of Woodhouse,
like that kind
of, there?
Woodhouse is quite popular.
Yeah.
That's quite popular. But actually, books that make you laugh out loud, I think, are rare and to be treasured. And Molesworth, for me, not only do you have the fantastically timed prose of Geoffrey Willans, a great genius of prose writing by anybody's standards, but you have the magnificent cartoons of Ronald Searle, which are, so you have two for the price of one. You get brilliant prose and brilliant sketches. So I think it's a cheat, but it's very, very rich.
Well, we can't bring you Searle's drawings on radio, sadly, but we can bring you a passage from Molesworth. Harriet, if you would.
We can't bring you the spelling either, but I shall enjoy that while I read it. Visiting the school. The day the parents come means much activity at the school. All rude drawings and propaganda, down with the mallmongers, meeting at Dalston Friday, are wiped off blackboards. School dog is muzzled, boys wash their necks, and the bath is cleaned. Next, masters are let out of their cells in new suits, mashers, ties, etc., and are forced by the headmaster to toe party line. Have you been guilty of imperialist dogma in break by pinching a boy's cup of cocoa? I have. Have you practiced sabotage against the school piano by cutting wires so that low C sounds plunk? I have. Do you admit this led to subversive singing of Jiken John Plunk in his Plunk So Gay? I do. Do you further admit to placing three tin ashtrays on the top of the said piano? I do. So that class sing Jia Tinkle Plunk John Plunk Tinkle in his Tinkle Tinkle Zing? They did. Were you also a tool of Wall Street by interfering with the metronome while music mistress was singing Trees at the school concert? I was. Did you express the view that even if the music mistress was a tree, you would not like her planted in your garden? Yes. Who invented the first railway engine? Stalin.
One of the things that's wonderful about that, partly it's just the beautiful comic timing of it, I think, a wonderful placing of words, and the spelling, of course, is a joy in its own right. But of course, at one level, it's actually a satire, you know, not only of a minor public school, but it's about the Moscow show trials. You know, it's all this stuff about Stalin and the steam engine show trials, the stuff about CND, down with the warmongers, meeting doors on Friday. It's, the jokes are very much about the grown-up world as well as the child world.
Are you sure you're not just trying to add hidden depth to our image of
I have to say that there is, of course, although Tim has unfairly described Nigel as no intellectual, he has a very there's a very good chapter about Proust. There's
I
a
said
very
he was
good
chapter. A great philosopher.
Sorry, before then the books aren't terribly intellectual. There's a wonderful chapter about Proust. Do you remember where Nigel pretends to the headmaster Grimes that he's been reading Swan's Way, which finally ends with Grimes saying, "Silence, boy, there is no such book."
Yes. This is in danger of turning into the Molesworth fan club. Thank you all very much indeed. I'm afraid that's where our time runs out. Thanks very much to our guests, Tim Rice, Kevin Jackson, and Harriet Walter, and all the past castaways whose book choices we've been scrutinising. Enjoy the rest of tonight's prom.
Mariella Frostrup presented this evening's Proms Plus Literary event, and the producer was Allegra McElroy. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall and part two of this particularly unusual prom, marking 7 decades of the Radio 4 programme Desert Island Discs. So far, we've heard the musical choices of castaways, including Sir David Attenborough and Darcy Bustle. The BBC Concert Orchestra is providing the music, sometimes on their own, sometimes accompanying the Huddersfield Choral Society or distinguished soloists, some of whom have been castaways themselves. Kirsty Young will be meeting plenty more castaways between now and the end of the concert. And the Desert Island Discs team is hosting a live blog where you can share your Desert Island choices and talk about the prom as it happens. You can find the blog by visiting the Radio 4 homepage or visit the prom's homepage at bbc.co.uk/proms and follow the links. And that applause is for Principal Conductor Keith Lockhart returning to the platform to start the second half of the prom with another theme I think you'll recognise.
Well, Simon West-Nobby, I do feel as if we should have jogged on to that, but I can't quite manage it in these heels. Welcome to Desert Island Discs at the Proms. It is wonderful to have you here, Falklands war veteran and a very well-known man, clearly, in this auditorium. Last week, you marked the Cardiff Festival by lighting the Olympic torch for the Paralympics. Now, that must have been a pretty special moment.
It was immense. It was something that not many people are going to get a chance to do, not in this country. There's only 4 to do it in the evening like that. But it was an immensely proud moment for me. I have a huge respect for Paralympians. You know, they've overcome nature and man-made adversity, and they go on to achieve so brilliantly, and we watch them now and see how they achieve. They're just so inspirational.
You yourself... You yourself have faced a good deal of man-made adversity, to use your phrase. It was on the Sir Galahad in 1982 that you met with great trauma and horror. I'm wondering, coming on to a program like Desert Island Discs, where you talk on the public stage about something that is incredibly intimate and personal, why did you make a decision to do that, and what effect did it have?
Sometimes you can live with your own ghosts for far too long, and it's nice to be able to get it out. And other people then understand, you know, people see you and they see you on TV, but they only get to see a short clip, and sometimes it's nice just to express yourself in your own words, and so that other people understand exactly who you are and what you've been through. But not just you, because you're almost, to take the earlier part of the conversation, you're almost a torchbearer for those who served with you and those who didn't come home. You know, so it's important, and I think it's important that people don't forget the sacrifice and the service that so many make, and all those ones who don't come home, and the families that are bereaved, you know, that they are remembered as well.
I should mention to people we came on there to Barry Stoller's Offside, which was one of the pieces that you chose from Match of the Day, of course. We're going to hear one of your other choices a little later on. But for now, Simon, a great inspiration to so many people, very clear from the applause. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Well, our next castaway tonight was once voted the nation's favourite actress. She is Patricia Routledge. Patricia, can I welcome you, please, on stage? Thank you for coming. So many endless cheers. We are spoiling you tonight. I hope you appreciate this. Patricia, you've been cast away twice on Desert Island Discs, and on both occasions, I understand you took, was it tea-making facilities and a selection of teas?
Yes, indeed.
Tell me about that.
Yes. Two china cups and saucers, a silver tea set, and every known kind of tea and tisane. Two cups and saucers for when somebody flies in to collect me. And I shall serve it in a large picture hat, a floral dress, and gloves. Because, of course, appearances have to be kept up.
I should just check, was there builder's tea in there as well, just in case you wanted...
No, not at my address.
I thought not. Now, you're a lover not just of tea, but of poetry too. You've taken with you various an anthology of poetry and the collected works of John Donne.
Yes.
It's pianistic poetry, really, that we're going to hear tonight as one of your choices. Just explain a little bit about what we're going to hear and why you chose it for discs.
It's a glorious piece. I love the piano. Beethoven loved the piano, and with this gloriously affirmative generosity of music, it would take me through any kind of lows or highs.
Patricia Routledge, CBE, thank you very much for joining us this evening. Thank you. Well, I should tell you that the soloist, who is about to join the BBC Concert Orchestra, also chose the piece he's about to play when he was cast away. That was in 1988. It is Beethoven's Emperor Concerto, and here to play the first movement with the BBC Concert Orchestra and Keith Lockhart is Peter Donohoe.
Thank you. Thank you.
Magnificent. Peter Donohoe was the soloist in the first movement of Beethoven's fifth piano concerto, the Emperor Concerto. Keith Lockhart conducted the BBC Concert Orchestra, and I'm wondering if Peter Donohoe is off for a lie down now, because I can secretly tell you that his luxury was a waterbed. 185 castaways have chosen pianos, but Peter Lockhart wasn't... Peter Donohoe, rather, wasn't one of them. Now, the stage crew behind me are about to remove this piano, and as they do that, I would like to welcome onto the stage here John Sessions.
I really must confess, Mr. Plumley, that you strike a somewhat different figure from what I had expected. The luxuriant blonde hair and the rather fetching, one might almost say feminine, clothing that does you no little justice, I have to say.
How are you?
I'm very well. I don't know if you've already helped yourself to the hospitality, but I'm hoping we'll get through the next few minutes. 20-odd years ago that you were cast away, and when you were at the time, as you were introduced, you said, you know, I'm one of those people that it's very difficult to classify. Is it any easier, do you think, to classify you?
That's being a rather pretentious idiot, I think. I think I'm an actor. I like people applauding, and I don't like it when they don't applaud.
Right.
So I'm pretty straightforward, I think. That's very nice of you people. Yeah.
I often find that on Desert Island Disc, when I speak to actors and actresses, they are the people who more than anybody else have imagined themselves in the circumstances of actually trying to live and survive on a desert island.
Uh-huh.
Now, you are in the position of actually, you appeared in a film called Castaway.
I was in a film called Castaway with the late great, and he was great in many ways, Oliver Reed.
Yes.
Did you know that Oliver Reed actually topped Sean Connery as the top British box office draw in 1969. Anyway, we did this film, very quick, Kirsty, but we did a film together, this Castaway, and I had to play his best man, and scenes with Oliver Reed chucking lager over my head and lots of nonsense like that. Anyway, I was also doing Spitting Image at the time, and myself and one of my colleagues had just done a sketch the night before where we'd done Peter O'Toole and Oliver Reed. One had the legs chopped off, and the other one had a sex change for a bet. Peter O'Toole's line was, I used to be Peter O'Toole, now I'm Peter No-Toole. Anyway, so the director was a chap called Nicholas Rogue, a very distinguished director, and his boy was one of the runners on it, just a young lad who makes the actors cups of tea and things. And he told Ollie that I'd done him the night before on television. So I was in the makeup trailer, and there's a mirror in front of me with lots of light bulbs around it. And Ollie came in, and his great bullfrog head came down next to me. It was rather like that scene in Jurassic Park, when the Tyrannosaurus Rex looks into the car, and he got hold of my head and started spinning it. And I thought, he's going to put my head right through the mirror. And he went, you're a funny little Herbert, aren't you?
We could listen to you all night, but we do have to get on to the music.
Yeah. We're running late, by the way.
We are actually running very late. Yeah. We're going to choose not your favoured disc, not the one you'd save from the waves. That was a bit of Mahler. But tonight we're going to hear some Puccini.
Absolutely.
Opera is a big, important
love
part
opera.
Of the, yes.
I go to lots of opera. I absolutely adore it. And very recently I saw the Otello at the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden. I don't know if anyone's seen it. It's absolutely wonderful. It's one of the best productions I've ever seen. Thank you. Well clapped, madam. And sir. Or is it sir? It was just the colour of that dress. That was all right. Yes, so I'm a big fan of... Funny, I've grown into Verdi. Like a lot of people, I came to Puccini very quickly. I mean, a lot of people are very snobbish about Puccini. Somebody called Tosca a shoddy little shocker. I can't remember who. But I love it. It's 90 minutes long. It goes straight to the point. And the aria I wish to hear, which Kirsty is alluding to... Vice d'arte, vice d'amore, is I live for art, I live for love. And it's once again a beautiful woman being given the sharp end by an absolute bastard, Scarpia. And it's my favorite, it's probably my favorite aria.
And on that note, John Sessions, we will say thank you very much.
No.
Thank you. So we are, in fact, going to hear two arias by Puccini, Visi d'Arte, I Lived for Art, and Un Bel Dì, One Fine Day. And to take the roles of Tosca and Madame Butterfly this evening, we have an irrepressible Irish soprano. She has had a fascinating career that's taken her to opera houses and concert halls all over the world, and yet somehow she's managed to stay fresh and untainted by the trappings of success. Ladies and gentlemen, she is Eilish Tynan.
Yeah.
So thank you very much there to Eilish for Ambaldi from Madame Butterfly and Visi d'Arte from Tosca, those two Puccini arias that she performed there. And thank you too to the BBC Concert Orchestra conducted by Keith Lockhart. So in the course of the evening, we have clearly been able to meet just a tiny fraction of the 3,000 people who featured as castaways on Desert Island Discs. And you can find out what music every castaway chose by going online to the programme's website on the Radio 4 homepage. You can also hear around 1,500 of the actual programmes now online. They make compelling listening, both for the human stories and, of course, for the wide selection of wonderful music. So to capture a flavour of the range of songs that are featured on the programme, David Chase has arranged the top 8 requested pop songs in Desert Island Discs history, and he's woven them into a piece specially commissioned for tonight's prom. It's orchestrated by Bill Elliott, and there's a chance for all of us to join in with the final number tonight, because that is my way. Before that, we are going to hear Mad Dogs and Englishmen, Over the Rainbow, La Vie en Rose, What a Wonderful World, Imagine, Underneath the Arches, and Je ne regrette rien. So, let's welcome back, what a selection, let's welcome back Eilish Tynan and Bryn Terfel, together with Simon Butteris, Anna J. Casey, and the Huddersfield Choral Society, to join the BBC Concert Orchestra and Keith Lockhart in the world premiere of Desert Island Hits.
There are certain times of day when all the citizens retire to take their clothes off and perspire. It's one of those rules that the greatest fools obey, because the sun is far too sultry and one must avoid its ultraviolet ray. The natives grieve when the white men leave their huts, because they're obviously definitely nuts. Mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. The Japanese don't care to, the Chinese wouldn't dare to. Hindus and Argentines deep firmly from 12 to 1. But Englishmen detest a siesta. In the Philippines they have lovely screens to protect you from the glare. In the Malay States they're hats like face which the Britishers won't wear. At 12 the moon and 8 is full and no further work is done. But mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. Rabbit deplores this foolish habit. In Hong Kong they strike a gong and fire off a noonday gun to reprimand each inmate who's in late. In the mangrove swamps where the python romps, there's peace from 12 to 2. Even caribous lie around and snooze, for there's nothing else to do. In Bengal to move at all is seldom if ever done. But mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday. Out in the midday. Out in the midday. Out in the midday. Out in the midday.
Thank you. of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, sacred nights, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I think to myself, what a
Ma vie
then again, too few to mention.
I did what I had to do and saw it through without exemption.
I planned each charted course, each careful
I think you liked that, didn't you? So that was then the world premiere of Desert Island Hits, arranged by David Chase, orchestrated by Bill Elliott, and performed there by Eilish Tynan, Anna J. Casey, Simon Butteris, Bryn Terfel, the Huddersfield Choral Society, the BBC Concert Orchestra, conducted by Keith Lockhart, and all of you, too. Well done. So, that brings us very nearly to the end of this very special prom, celebrating 70 years of Desert Island Discs. A huge thank you to all the castaways who've joined me on stage this evening, and of course to all our performers. Those categories, of course, have sometimes overlapped. I'm Kirsty Young, and over the next few weeks, I'll be sharpening those gramophone needles ready for the next series of Desert Island Discs. The programme is back on air on the 23rd of September, and I do hope that you will all join me then. But just before we go, we're not the only ones who've been celebrating this year. The BBC Concert Orchestra is 60 this year. So, the final choice of music. And they don't look a day over 55, I would say. Anyway, the final choice of music tonight is theirs. We started the prom with, of course, the Desert Island Discs theme tune by The Sleepy Lagoon. That was composed by Eric Coates. And he also wrote the music that over the years has become the concert orchestra's signature piece, his Dam Busters March. Keith Lockhart, chalks away. Thank you.
The Dambusters March by Eric Coates. Keith Lockhart conducting the BBC Concert Orchestra, led tonight by Charles Mutter. As Kirsty Young said, they're celebrating their 60th anniversary this year. Since 1952, the orchestra's been the house orchestra for Radio 2's Friday Night is Music Night. It gives regular broadcasts, of course, on Radio 3. And tonight, it's been helping Radio 4 celebrate one of their longest-running programmes. Keith Lockhart was appointed principal conductor in 2010. He's also music director of the Boston Pops, a position he's held since 1995. And both those orchestras have been requested by castaways on Desert Island Discs over the years. Keith Lockhart returning to the stage with the soloists we heard performing in Desert Island Hits. Simon Buttress not making his debut at the Proms, incidentally, a seasoned Proms performer. Anna Jane Casey, Elish Tynan, and Bryn Terville. Behind them, getting to their feet now, are the Huddersfield Choral Society. The society celebrated its 175th anniversary last year. Their chorus master is Joseph Cullen. And Kirsty Young also taking a bow on stage as this Desert Island Discs anniversary prom comes to a close. From the Royal Albert Hall, it's good night from me. I'll hand you back to John Shea.
Thank you very much to Louise Fryer there presenting tonight's prom, and we'll be back at the Royal Albert Hall tomorrow evening when David Robertson will be conducting the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra in music by Brahms, Beethoven, Schoenberg and Gershwin tomorrow night at the usual time of 7:30. This is BBC Radio 3 at the not very usual time of 23 minutes past 10. I'm afraid we're running quite late because of tonight's live prom. Apologies for that. The essay, the first of this week's programmes, will now be on the air a little before 10 past 11, and it'll be followed by tonight's Jazz on 3 at just before 25 past 11. Before that, time for the last programme in this summer's series of the Lebrecht interview. Here's Norman Lebrecht to introduce this evening's guest.
John Adams is one of the most successful composers alive today, certainly the most successful opera composer, some would say the most controversial. His breakthrough work, Nixon in China, broke an age-old American convention of discretion and reverence for living presidents. His second opera, The Death of Klinghoffer, showed the terrorist murder of a disabled man. Recently, Dr. Atomic raised unsettling questions about the nuclear debate. Adams has been attacked by successive chief critics on the New York Times as insubstantial and seriously limited. Yet, his works have entered standard repertory, and they show new dimensions with each new production. An East Coaster who moved to San Francisco, John Coolidge Adams started composing at the age of 10 and heard his music performed before he started shaving. At first a minimalist with such titles as Common Tones in Simple Time, he worked tonally outwards to find a style that is melodic, emotional and intellectually stimulating. Batter My Heart from Dr. Atomic is the most arresting curtain aria in years. Politically liberal, Adams says he's been followed by US Secret Services and blacklisted by the Homeland Security Department. He's in London to conduct at the proms, and we meet up in a BBC studio. John Adams, you got through immigration without difficulty?
Yes, I did. And I think perhaps blacklisted was a choice of words that we were all throwing around back 10 years ago. But I was for several years on a watch list, but it's a list that you don't know about, and you know you're on it, but there's no explanation of why.
Well, how do you know you're on it?
You know you're on it because when you go to check in, there are always minor difficulties. But Ted Kennedy, the great senator, was also on it, so it's possible that my very, very familiar American name is just one that may have rung bells.
Well, it might have been another John Adams, or it could have been a dead president.
It could have been a dead president, or because of various newspaper articles that had my name with them and the Achille Lauro or terrorism or something like that, that it rang some bells.
But, were you disturbed by that?
I was annoyed by it because it's really very tedious.
What do? You pick up a phone and ring your senator?
I actually did speak to my senator, and she was appalled.
But she's from
California. Also head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, so I think that helped to get me off it.
Right. Did you feel harassed?
No, I think that, you know, after 2001, and particularly after the initiation of the Iraq War, that those of us who disagreed with the right wing and with Bush did feel put upon, because it was one of those you're either against us or you're with us type of attitudes. And it brought me back in certain ways to the Vietnam War when I was a teenager. But, you know, it's just kind of in the tenor of the times these days, particularly in the U.S., that the political debate is so toxic.
You grew up in what reads like a John Updike setting in your memoir. Small town Vermont and New Hampshire. Your mother, a singer in amateur musicals. No television in the house. Idyllic in its rural simplicities. Was it like that?
I think so. You know, it's difficult when you tell your life story, as I've done. I wrote an autobiography or memoir or whatever you want to call it, Hallelujah Junction. There's always a danger to create a narrative from your memory, and then you repeat it so often that it becomes a truth, I say, with quotation marks around it. And maybe my childhood wasn't as idyllic as I think it was, but I seemed to, even while I was living it, I was aware of it. You know, I discovered Charles Ives when I was about 12, I think. Leonard Bernstein recorded the Second Symphony, and up to that point, Ives was a completely unknown composer in most of the country. And I was aware of how similar my childhood was to Ives. And I was also aware that I was somewhat a loner. I wasn't in any way misanthropic. I liked other kids, and I spent time with them, but I was kind of obsessed with music, and I had this very rich, imaginative life where I already had written all these pieces, these symphonies and ballets and concertos. And
did they actually exist in your head, or were they?
They did.
They were just opus numbers.
They had opus numbers, and I could hum the tunes for you if you had run into me in those days. I had a paper route. Mm-hmm. I lived in a very small village in New Hampshire, and I remember that I'd go around, do the paper route, and the paper route took about 45 minutes, so most of my pieces were 45 minutes long.
Your father played clarinet, and so that became your instrument.
That's right. We didn't have a piano in the house. Neither my parents played, although they were both musical. I think my mother was probably the more natural musical talent. She was a wonderful singer, and she sang Broadway tunes and acted in a local theater company, but she had absolutely no musical training. And for both of my parents, the idea of getting me solidly grounded in music, my father taught me the clarinet, and then
You played in bands.
I played in bands, but I started exhibiting tendencies towards creativity when I was very young, and my parents, God bless them, they saw this, and they...
How did they see it?
I think that they were both people who loved the arts, and neither of them had graduated from college, but they had previously lived in a small village in Vermont that was full of very intellectual refugees from New York and Boston, most of them Jewish. Many of them were left-wing people who had been chased out during the McCarthy era. And it was from these people that I was exposed, for example, to Stravinsky and to Mozart and Beethoven and Tchaikovsky. And so my parents were keen enough to realize that they should find me somebody to teach me counterpoint and harmony.
At what age?
I think I probably took my first lesson when I was about 10 or 12 or so. And I started writing melodies and then started studying harmony. And as I tell this tale in my book, the first orchestra that I played in was sponsored by the New Hampshire State Mental Hospital. And we would rehearse on, I think, every Monday night, and then a couple of times a year give a concert. And the concert was, we usually have a light classic piece, like, I don't know, 1812 overture or unfinished symphony or movement from a Mozart symphony, and then maybe Sound of Music or theme songs from Oklahoma, and would always end with a march. And the audience was a room full of severely disturbed mental patients. And these were probably in the years before most patients like this were just controlled with drugs. So these patients showed their emotions, and they showed them immediately while cheering and yelling or breaking into tears at the first sound of music. So it was a very primal experience for me to understand how immensely powerful music's essence is. And I think at that early age, I realized that music is about feeling. And this is interesting because, of course, a few years later, I end up in college at Harvard University, and it's the 60s, and it's the period when feeling is being chased out of the musical experience, and it's all intellect. So it took me a while to come around and realize the importance of that lesson I learned there in that hall in the mental hospital.
Describe the sensation of hearing your own music performed for the first time. You were, what, 13, 14?
Yes. Well, I think the principal thing was that I had composed this piece. It was a suite for string orchestra. And the thing that I remember more than anything was how out of tune it was. I had to get over the fact that amateur string players sounded so sour. I don't really recall whether I was thrilled with the sound of my own music, but it obviously stimulated me to keep on doing it.
Did your parents make a comment?
Oh, they were thrilled. I mean, wouldn't you be? I have two very talented children myself. They're not children anymore. One's a composer who just had his third orchestra piece premiered by Michael Tilson Thomas, and a daughter who's a very gifted painter. And I know that feeling of being a parent and seeing a young kid and identifying their talent and fostering it. It's just such a key thing to be able to do.
So then you go on to Harvard, Ivory Towers, and the austere...
I beg your pardon. Harvard was no ivory tower in the late 1960s. It was combat zone, okay. Cultural combat zone.
Well, cultural and political.
Yes, of course, you know.
And you go into the class of the composer Leon Kirchner, who says you've got to write like Schoenberg or nobody will take you seriously. Was that about right?
No, that's not quite right. I think that Leon was an exception. The most influential figure in the academy during those years was Milton Babbitt, whom I later met and found to be an absolutely lovely guy with a great, wicked sense of humor. My teacher, Leon Kirchner, had been a student of Schoenberg's, and he was, he was a real musician. He spent his summers at the Marlboro Music Festival and conducted with Rudolf Serkin and Alexander Schneider, and he was really part of that great tradition of first-generation Europeans who brought the great principles of Schnabel and Casals and Schoenberg. And Leon was not your sort of garden variety, cloistered college academic. In fact, he was really a fish out of water in the university. But he was immensely intelligent. And I think he was immensely unhappy with what had happened to music. And his own music is this white-hot romanticism that's kind of caught in this unhappy straitjacket of the kind of atonality that one felt was necessary to write in the 1960s. There is a tension that's never resolved, and I think that tension was something that I picked up on and I rebelled against. And of course, at the same time that students were all worried about Webern and Boulez and Stockhausen, you'd walk out of the very quiet classrooms of the music department and walk across Harvard Yard and and hear the Rolling Stones or Jimi Hendrix pouring out of the dorm windows, and there was Dionysus for you.
And you were tempted?
It wasn't a question of being tempted. I was enchanted by it, and I was thoroughly a child of the times. I loved that music, and I listened to it, and I knew it as well as anyone else.
Politically, you went on marches?
I did. I don't think I was any different than most of the kids. I mean, if I can say it on the BBC, our asses were in a sling. All of us who were males were all looking at getting sent to Vietnam, and it was a question of how to get out of it. So, of course, you know, I marched in several large protests, and at one point I was chased down Massachusetts Avenue by a Cambridge cop wielding a club, and got a true taste of the class divide. That was 1971, I think, 70 or 71, and it was a very exciting time. It was also a very troubling time. I mean, we really wanted this to be over. Hmm. The country was rent in a way that it's never been in my lifetime, probably not since the McCarthy era. And I decided I wanted to get away from where I'd grown up and from the East Coast, so I got in a car and drove across the country to California.
One of the things that took you across the country, that took you west, was this discovery of minimalism, Terry Riley, and so forth. Was that the attraction, to go to a music that was as different as possible from the austerity that was being preached at Harvard?
I cannot exactly remember whether music was the initial impulse for my decision. I had been reading a lot of beat literature. I'd been reading Jack Kerouac, and there's a great book by Henry Miller, author of Tropic of Cancer, called Big Sur and the Oranges of Hieronymus Bosch, which describes 7 years of his life living after he returned from living in Europe. He went and he lived in a tiny hamlet of artists up on the cliffs overlooking the Pacific. And I think I was drawn by that romantic idea. I'd just never been out of New England. I'd never been to Europe. I'd never been anywhere. But I did know that there were great rock bands out there, and it was a different kind of life. I just wanted to see what it was like. I didn't have any inkling that I would spend the rest of my life there.
Hotel California.
That's right.
The music itself. Yeah. You've never wanted to be called minimalist.
No, well, I rejected the term for myself. Right. Actually, there was a 4 or 5 year period where I was not that cognizant of minimalism. I was a real acolyte of John Cage, and the first concerts that I produced with my students out in California, I mean, there's a chapter missing that I haven't discussed about just how I lived hand to mouth when I first got out to California, working on the waterfront in Oakland, and
you were doing pretty menial jobs.
Yeah, but it was a good experience, and I actually was probably one of the few composers who could actually talk to Cornelius Carter when I finally met him about being a working class guy. But I did eventually start teaching at this very small school, the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, and one of my assignments was to produce new music concerts. So I knew all my John Cage very well, and I was very deeply imbued in John's orthodoxy. And I do think that Cage is a very orthodox composer. That surprises people because they think of him as an iconoclast, but he actually is a strangely intolerant composer in a certain way when it comes to anything that doesn't fit into his very precise world. Mm. And that means most of Western music, whether it's Miles Davis or Beethoven. You know, eventually I just had to throw that out because I had fun doing John Cage, and you could talk about it forever. But, you know, my background and my musical breeding had brought me up to love great music. And also, I keep going back to this experience about knowing that music is essentially the art of feeling. And Cage had no place in that. So when I did hear my first minimalist pieces, I was thrilled. I think the first one I heard live was Drumming by Steve Reich. And I was really thrilled because here was something that was aurally beautiful. It was sensuous on a sound level. It had musical structure. It had development. And it had a beat, which was something that had been missing from contemporary music for so long.
And yet the first piece that you write that actually makes an impact, you've written quite a few pieces before then, but the one possibly the orchestral breakthrough piece was Harmonielehre, which takes its title and idea from Schoenberg. So you've gone back to the other extreme.
Well, actually, Harmonielehre was about a fifth or sixth piece in a growth period for me. I think the most important first work that I did was a piano piece called Phrygian Gates, which is clearly minimalist, but also exhibits such a kind of explosive energy to break the kind of minimalist straitjacket. And that was followed by a piece called Shaker Loops, which is still done a great deal today. It's probably one of my most popular pieces. Harmonielehre came about 8 or 9 years later. And that was a piece that was, it was kind of a whimsical piece because I'd had a commission to write a large work for symphony orchestra. And I had been reading Schoenberg's textbook on harmony. And I got this crazy idea of taking the language that Schoenberg was renouncing, which is the kind of fin du siècle language we hear in, I don't know, in Mahler's Tenth, for example, or in Pelléas or Gurlitter, and then mixing it with minimalist principles. It was a crazy idea, but it worked.
Another paradox. Going to California, instead of being totally laid back and hanging out, you become immersed in German literature and philosophy, and you mix, I think you once told me, all of your friends are academics. You live in quite a high-minded community.
I live in Berkeley, California. I don't teach there, but I live there. And yes, I mean, some of our friends are Nobel Prize winners and brilliant chemists and physicists and historians, but that not all of our friends are like that. What's curious, though, and upsetting to me, is that even amongst people as brilliant as that, how few of them listen to classical music. I would say that scientists do listen to classical music. But, for example, you know, we live on a fairly small street. Everyone on the street knows each other. And everyone knows I'm a composer, but they wouldn't know my music if they heard it because they listen to the Gypsy Kings or they listen to 70s rock or 60s rock if they're in their 50s or so. And it's a measure of just how in American society classical music has just gradually become smaller and smaller in terms of its reach. Part of this I attribute to the enormous influence of popular music and the radio and now, of course, listening to music online. But it's also, I think, a very sad result of the fact that classical music is just not valued. For example, you couldn't possibly run for president of the United States and come out and say that you loved Mahler. You'd be ridiculed.
You'd be loved.
It would be like, you know, when John Kerry, you know, he spoke apparently perfect French because he'd gone to school in Switzerland at some point, and he had to conceal that when he ran for president. So it's partly an anti-intellectual thing, which has a great history in the United States. I mean, you can read about it in Martin Chuzzlewit. But I think it's also the fact that kids don't listen to classical music when they're kids. When they're young, they don't play musical instruments at the level that we played them